From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Practicing medicine used to be a matter of making a diagnosis and then looking up the right treatment. Well, not anymore. Thanks to the genetic revolution, doctors today can tailor-make drugs and treatments for individual patients. As a result, some doctors predict a whole new era of personalized medicine.
I tell my students that I'm envious of them because they're so young and on the cusp of what will be one of the great changes in medicine, comparable to the time when hospitals went from being places you went to die to the development of anesthesia and aseptic surgery, where hospitals were places you went where people could really do something for you and change the quality of your life.
But as medical treatments get more powerful, they also become more dangerous. And putting your faith in hospitals is not always a good idea, as Gary Wolkstein found out. Now, Gary had every reason to trust his doctors. 2 years ago, they found a tumor on one of his kidneys, removed it, and gave him a clean bill of health. No more cancer, no further treatment, no expected recurrence. So life was looking pretty good. The day after his wife left to take their oldest daughter to begin college, Gary had what he thought would be a routine annual exam, including a CAT scan. Turned out to be anything but routine.
About 4:30 that afternoon on Tuesday, I was home, and there was a telephone call, and I picked up the phone, and it was the urologist, and he said in a rather brusque manner, "I have some bad news for you." And I kind of found myself without breath, but said, "Well, what?" And he says, "Well, this does not look good, but we think there may be metastases of your cancer from your kidney." The statistics were incredibly grim. There was 2 tumors on my spine and a possible additional one in the same kidney, of which part of it had been removed. Cancer cells, while they are in the kidney, if they are removed, you have a very good prognosis. If they metastasize, the prognosis is very bad, because cancer cells are ones which are used to filter out poisons from the body. So they are so resilient that chemotherapy is basically ineffective. In the meantime, my wife and 3 children were stopping in Detroit on the way to Cleveland to stay at my wife's father's home. And my wife called me on Wednesday to find out how the test had gone. I mean, this is going to be just another 6-month check. And so I did, thinking about it, and I talked to some friends, and I concluded that this had been so startling, so upsetting to me. I was too afraid of what might happen with my wife and my family while they were driving, that this could distract my wife. She could get into an accident. I could lose my whole family. So I decided the only alternative was to lie. And when I spoke to her on Wednesday night, I basically just said, it went okay, and changed the subject as quickly as I could. I did feel hopeless and that went through, why is this happening to me, and how can this be happening to me, that there's so much more that I want to do with my life. There were interesting periods of real calm in which one of my friends asked me whether or not I felt ready to die. And it was funny that my reaction was immediately, not at all. I had no sense whatsoever that what I was going to do in my life, or the effect I was going to have on other people and the relationships I was going to have, was drawing to a conclusion. And I had this sense, which in a way kind of seems pat, but it nevertheless rang very true for me, which was, I was committed to watching my kids grow up. I just felt, no, this is not going to be cut short, and that as long as I was going to be able to, you know, actively be a part of their lives and be a part of my wife's life, I was going to do what was necessary. That night, my wife returned with two of our children. When she returned, I had the desire to immediately tell her all that had happened, because there's nobody in the world that's closer to me, and I wanted to share with her the worst news I'd ever had in my life. But there was a part of me where I just realized somebody cannot be told that level of intensity when they've just been upset about dropping their daughter off at college. I mean, she was already, you know, quite worried about that, and it was a big change in our lives, and to come back and get a report like this was just too much. I mean, she had just driven 10 hours, and to tell her everything at once, I thought was just not fair and not humane. So I asked my wife, after she'd settled in a little bit, to go for a walk. And during this walk, I told her part of the story, and I was vague about statistics, and I was vague about the areas that made it seem even more grim, and just told her, well, I was going to be going in for more information, and that we would just make decisions about what to do. My wife came back from this walk and immediately called up one of our very close friends, who's a physician and an internist. And during this time, I was fortunate enough to even have another friend in town who is not only an internist, a physician and an internist, but she had experience working in nephrology, kidney treatment. In any case, what happened from there was an appointment was set up for a second appointment with this oncologist. Julie and Laurel, two of these physicians, actually came to that appointment with me. They wanted to look at the CAT scans, they wanted to question the doctor, and they'd proceeded to do that. None of them were convinced that the diagnosis was accurate. They pushed, and I pushed, for a more definitive test. And the more definitive test was an MRI. The oncologist was quite resistant and basically said that he felt more than 95% certain of the diagnosis. The sense I had of him when he was talking to me was that he felt I was in denial, and I didn't want to hear it, and my friends didn't want to hear it. And what he wanted to do was to press us to begin high-dosage radiation to my spine. And what we later learned was this was not the protocol. The protocol was somebody who has metastases about a year from when they've had a malignancy in their tumor and it looks like it's spread, you don't get an MRI. One of my friends, with exasperation, just said, well, if you won't schedule it, I will. And she went out in the hall, took out her cell phone, called up another hospital. And this is during Labor Day weekend, which is, of course, very difficult to schedule anything, and got me an appointment within a few days. My friend set it up. I went in for the MRI. The other friend called up the radiologist and found out what his telephone number was so that she could dial up and read his dictation, because, you know, when a radiologist reads it, they actually dictate. She read it that night, and what he said was he found no metastases. He did not find that there were cancer spots on my spine, but found what are known as Schmerl's nodes. Those are benign nodes, which can be the result of just a fall. And yes, there'd be some additional bone growth, but it's not cancer. And he was quite definitive about this. My friend called me and was just ecstatic. I mean, she said, there is no better news that you could receive. And I learned later on that what happened was there was a whole gathering of all the radiologists who went over these films and one by one concurred that it was indeed Schmerl's nodes, benign. Over the course of the two appointments after that, I was so disappointed that no time during these conversations did this oncologist ever apologize, ever accept any responsibility for having strongly recommended I get high doses of radiation to my spine, or that he had for over the course of what it now was now about a period of a month put myself and my wife through hell. I mean, we all felt that I had slim to no chance of recovering from a fatal disease and these metastases. And his way of responding was, isn't this wonderful? He kind of jumped on the bandwagon to, this is incredible news, and it's almost as if you were at the in the electric chair and the governor called and you've got a reprieve. So I look back on this, and having told this story to some personal friends, most of them gulp when they hear the story and saying, well, I don't have, you know, physician friends, and nor do I have anyone else who I could really turn to as an advocate, and probably I would follow the recommendations of the physician. So there's a certain responsibility I have to kind of pass on the message that people really have to advocate for themselves.
Gary Wolkstein is currently a practicing attorney in Madison, Wisconsin. Had he gone ahead with the radiation therapy, he would be in a wheelchair today. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Practicing medicine by the book or by the hospital protocol works most of the time. The exceptions, though, can be pretty scary. For instance, adverse drug reactions kill 100,000 Americans annually. But what if there were a way to find out ahead of time which drugs might be dangerous for you? Richard Wenschelbaum, a professor of pharmacology at the Mayo Clinic, is leading an effort to do just that. It's called pharmacogenetics. Wenschelbaum told Steve Paulson it's an outgrowth of the 21st century explosion in drug therapies.
I've been teaching medical students at Mayo for nearly 30 years, and what they take for granted today represents drugs that just weren't available when I started teaching these medical students, not even to mention the time prior to that I was in medical school. So that, I think what both the medical students and the public at large fails to realize is that we can do things medically today that we could never do before. But what that means is that these drugs, which make it possible to take diseases like childhood leukemia, the most common cancer of children, and cure 85% of these children who, when I was in medical school, uniformly and tragically all died, means that the drugs that we use to do that can do great good, but they also are very powerful and in a few patients can do great harm. What we don't or haven't understood is why, when we use exactly the same dose of these drugs in a group of people, most of them will do fine. Some won't have the desired effect, and if we're treating a disease like leukemia, that's a tragedy. And some, the drugs will have too much effect. We'll get an adverse response, an excessive response, and the drugs can actually put the patient's life at risk.
Can you give me an example of how this would work, why the particular genetics of one person would respond to a drug in one way and not the same way in other people?
Absolutely. And the example I used from leukemia wasn't chosen randomly. It was chosen because the work that we began here at Mayo 20 years ago, we were trying to understand why some children with leukemia have these serious adverse responses to these wonderful drugs that cure so many of the rest of the kids. What we found was that there's a common genetic variation in one of the pathways that the body uses to get rid of one of the major drugs that's used to treat childhood leukemia. So that inadvertently, because of this genetic variation, we were giving too much of the drug to some of these children. It's about one out of every 300 children who genetically gets two copies of a gene so that their body makes a variant form of the enzyme that the body uses to get rid of this drug. Those kids, we can treat with the drugs, but at one-tenth the standard dose. That is, we individualize today or tailor the therapy based on their ability, their body's ability genetically, to get rid of the medication.
Give me a few other examples of common drugs that are out there that may have damaging effects.
Well, the place that this is most important, obviously, is when we're using potentially powerful and therefore potentially very dangerous drugs, such as those that are used to treat cancer. So that another similar example relates to a drug called 5-fluorouracil, which is used to treat breast cancer and colon cancer. As a result of a tragedy which occurred about 15 years ago when a woman with breast cancer was treated with, quote, standard doses of 5-fluorouracil, developed profound toxicity, in this case leading to coma and eventually to death, we then found that this woman and a small percentage of other people lack the ability to metabolize 5-fluorouracil. Much more common, but less dramatic, is another enzyme called cytochrome P450-2D6, known to its friends as CYP2D6. About 5 to 10% of a European population has a variant form of this enzyme, so they have low enzyme activity, exactly the sort of thing that I've been talking about. Those people, when treated with codeine, don't get any pain relief. The reason is that codeine requires CYP2D6 to be converted to morphine, so you get pain relief. And for years, certainly when I was in medical school, we thought that some people would take codeine and they would say, I don't get any pain relief. And of course, the assumption was it's, quote, in their head. Well, it wasn't in their head, it was in their liver. Conversely, there are some people who have multiple copies of the 2D6 gene. Up to 13 copies, so that they are super metabolizers. The first case of this was a nurse who had depression and was being treated with standard antidepressant medications and was getting no response. And of course, the immediate assumption was that she wasn't taking the medications. But being medically sophisticated, she demanded that they put her, this was at the Karolinska in Stockholm, in Sweden. She demanded that they put her in the hospital and test her. They gave her the medications, and yet she didn't have any blood drug levels. Well, the reason was she had 13 copies of this gene, and her body was gobbling up the drug much faster than anyone else's. Now, that's unusual in Europeans, but in people from East Africa, from Ethiopia or Somalia, those people, 30% of them will have multiple copies of this gene. So standard doses of drugs that would work perfectly well for Europeans are underdosing those patients.
Now, you have said that this whole field of pharmacogenetics will spark a revolution in medicine, that it will really lead to more personalized medicine, so the particular drug treatments will be tailor-made to each person's specific genetic code. Tell me how this would work practically. I mean, when someone checks in to see the doctor and wants a prescription, how will that play out?
Well, the blue sky scenario, or what I think we would all hope someday would happen, is that we would know all of the common genetic variation in all of the genes that encode proteins that are involved in drug response, whether they be proteins that are involved in drug metabolism or transporting drugs in and out of the body, or the targets for drugs, which also can show genetic variation.
So a person's genetic history will be part of their medical report that their doctors will have?
So that the patient will have a blood sample drawn and will be able, using some of these new high-throughput DNA chip technologies, to be able to tell that person, you're just fine for your ability to sulfate drugs, but your ability to methylate is a little low and your cytochrome P450-2D6 is too high. Now, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of these drug metabolizing enzymes, but it would all be available for you, confidential, so it's between you and your physician would have a little reader that would read this information out as he or she got ready to write your prescription, and your dose would be tailored, or the selection of the drug would be tailored for your own genotype. Now, let me immediately say, there are bits and pieces of that already occurring today. But the blue sky scenario that I've just painted certainly is something that we see in the future, but probably not as far in the future as people of my advanced age would have thought a few years ago.
How far in the future are we talking?
Probably 5 years in the future, a great deal of this information would be a part of standard medical practice.
You sound pretty excited about this. This must be a good time to be a medical researcher.
This is a wonderful time to be a medical researcher, and I've described this to other people as the completion of the Genome Project, all the exciting new technologies we have available, as the equivalent of being a kid in a candy store, because for years we've been dealing with these problems, and now we're beginning to have, this will truly be a period over the next decade or so of a quantum leap with regard to our ability to understand and we hope to treat and prevent disease.
Richard Winchelbaum is a professor of pharmacology at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
It was on a Monday morning, I was tired.
My head was turning.
And I couldn't face the thought of going back to work.
And so
I paid a visit to my doctor.
And he gave me the once over.
Said, don't worry, we'll soon have you on the go.
You need pills.
Pills, 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 a pill can do.
Well, I took the dose of water
and my energy was restored.
But I was twitching.
I was itching.
Couldn't keep my body still.
So I twitched right back to see the quack.
Ah, yes,
he said,
we'll soon cure that.
I'll just prescribe another little pill.
You need pills.
Pills, pills, pills.
Just swallow two, three times a day.
You'll be as good as new.
And we've got pills to make you happy. Pills to pep you up and calm you down.
It's magic what the pill can do.
Because we all need pills.
Pills, pills, pills.
Take the pain away.
Just swallow two, three times a day. You'll be as good as new.
And we've got pills to make you happy. Pills to pep you up and calm you down.
It's magic what the pill can do.
Magic what the pill can do.
Magic what the pill can do for you.
The McCommons, recorded live in Edinburgh from the CD Festival Lights. Now, everyone likes a good tune, but can music actually heal? Can it rewire a damaged brain? Some 30 years ago, Oliver Sacks was one of the first doctors to discover the therapeutic power of music. At the time, Sacks worked with patients suffering from advanced Parkinson's disease. Many had been institutionalized for decades, barely able to walk or even talk. And then in a few cases, something miraculous happened. When those patients listened to music, they came alive. Sacks called their cases awakenings. And he wrote a best-selling book, which later became a movie with that title. Music therapy has come a long way since then, and Sacks says he's still amazed by the power music has on some patients.
People who were often motionless and speechless, unless there were music, and then such people who sometimes couldn't take a step could dance, people who couldn't utter a syllable could sing, and music somehow seemed to allow them a flow which they couldn't have at other times.
Now, what exactly does it mean that there is an effect of music? It's not every time or any kind of music that you play that will elicit this response from the patients, is it?
No, I don't think it's an automatic or mechanical response. I think the music needs to flow. It mustn't be too staccato. On the other hand, I think it needs to have a well-defined rhythmic structure. It mustn't be too slushy. I think it helps if it's familiar and emotionally evocative for the person.
You talk about familiar music. When you've seen the effect of music on a patient, is it likely that it is something that they've known? Now, you described one patient in Awakenings, for instance, who it sounded as though what she was doing was remembering playing the music of Chopin.
Well, that particular patient was a gifted musician and happened to, you know, love Chopin and Schubert. What was striking with her was that I would often see her sometimes transfixed for hours with a finger on her glasses, you know, in a state in which she had no sense of time elapsing. and she could stay in the state for hours. But at the piano, she had perfect tempo. But it was even sufficient asking her to think of a piece. She knew all Chopin by heart, and I remember once saying to her, Opus 49. And the F minor fantasy started in her mind, and with that, the Parkinsonism sort of melted, and her brain waves, her EEG, which we were recording, became almost normal. So the imagination, the vivid imagination of music, is sometimes as effective as the inaction, which maybe isn't surprising because one knows now with brain imagery that visual imagery activates the visual cortex in the same way as actually seeing something, and musical imagery seems to activate parts of the auditory system in the same way.
What kind of effect is there from this? Does it have any lasting effect? The woman who could imagine playing Chopin, what physical response would there be to that?
While she is playing it or imagining it or hearing it, the rigidity, the shaking, and other features of the Parkinsonism disappear, and she can move fairly easily, and she is bypassing her Parkinsonism at that time. But the moment the music stops, the Parkinsonism is back. I mean, in a way, it had only sort of disappeared or been bypassed. Incidentally, there are other forms of music, if you want, other than auditory music. I think of one Parkinsonian woman who used to like juggling in her youth. She would juggle with oranges, with three or four oranges, and while the juggling was going on, while the rhythmic rise and fall of the oranges was going on, she was not Parkinsonian. But if she dropped one of the oranges, in that moment, she would get transfixed again.
So that there are no permanent effects from this. Does it have any practical effects for them?
Yes, indeed, because I think it can allow movement and facilitate movement and speech. And thinking and emotion, it can allow the person to move internally and externally.
And this is true for a variety of illnesses.
Yes, well, I think certainly it's very important in people with Alzheimer's, but also with people who've had strokes and head injuries, have language problems, and sometimes have peculiar difficulties doing things or executing sequences, which you sometimes also see with frontal lobe injury. Now, one of the things which intrigued and puzzled me is the power of music to give emotions and to give whole identities which may not be visible or available otherwise. And I thought of this in regard to one young autistic boy, as he was then, Stephen Wilshire, whom I've written about. Stephen has an immense savant gift for drawing. He does hugely complex drawings after looking at a building or a street, you know, for a couple of seconds. But he also has great musical abilities, which weren't in fact discovered until he was about 16 or 17, because everyone had been paying attention to the visual abilities.
Do you know how it was discovered?
I think people saw him dancing and singing in response to a record which was being played. But I've seen Stephen performing musically and singing, and he has all the gestures and the performing mannerisms of various singers. It looks like he's got it. I remember when I saw this, I wrote in my notebook, you know, not autistic at this moment, or something like this. But I think music can give all of us emotions and identities which we wouldn't otherwise have. There are fascinating descriptions of this by Tolstoy, who was immensely sensitive to music and greatly resented it. He was infuriated by music's power to give him emotions and evoke thoughts which he felt weren't his own. He had a very ambivalent relationship with Tchaikovsky for this reason. And of course, in his story, Kreutzer Sonata, a murder is committed in response to the power of music. But, you know, one listens to Mozart or Monteverdi, they take you into worlds which you couldn't possibly imagine otherwise. You share their consciousness. It's the wonder of all art. And I think this also is part of what's going on in music therapy. I think one can't just say it's rhythm, it's this, it's that. It's somehow the whole identity of the music.
I gather, in fact, that you had some personal experience of this. You wrote about being unmusicked at one point when you had a leg injury.
Oh, yes. Well, this was a phrase I picked up from one of my Parkinsonian patients who had been a music teacher and who spoke of being unmusicked. I am in 74. I had an injury in which I damaged the muscles and the nerves of one leg quite badly, and the leg was out of action and useless and effectively senseless and paralyzed for about 2 weeks after surgery.
You even wrote that you had no sense that it was there. It was as though it didn't exist for you?
Well, absolutely, I felt that. I also say in the afterword to the book, dear reader, you know, if you don't know what this is like, read this under spinal anesthesia, because then you will know. For example, if you have spinal anesthesia, I don't mean one of the sort of silly little epidurals people have now, but a real massive spinal anesthetic, which almost sort of transects the spinal cord, as it were, for a few hours. What happens then is not simply a loss of feeling and movement in the lower half, but a loss of the sense of its reality or its identity. If you look down at your lower half after a spinal anesthetic, you see a pair of legs and hips which have nothing to do with you. They may appear to be made of wax, to be a fine specimen from an anatomy museum, which are somehow incongruously attached to you. You subjectively stop at your umbilicus, you stop at your navel. So there is a subjective annihilation or alienation then of parts of the body, if there is no neural flow, no traffic of impulses from it, no traffic of impulses to it.
And this is the way you felt about that leg?
This was the situation with the leg, and it was the way I felt. It alarmed me, to put it mildly, because I hadn't expected this, and I didn't know if there would be any recovery.
Now, what role did music play in helping you to recover?
Well, after about 2 weeks, I was stood up. A little before that, I'd started to get some spontaneous jumping in the muscles, which showed that the innervation, the nerve supply, was coming back. And then I was stood up and asked to take a few steps. Those first steps were very bizarre, because it was almost like trying to operate a robot limb. If I didn't look down, I would take a step which was too large or too small, or which went across the other foot so that I tripped over it. It was a completely unnatural sort of situation. And then, suddenly, a friend had bought in a tape recorder and a tape, actually, of Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto. And after playing it dozens of times, you know, it was very strongly in my mind. And rather suddenly, as I was standing there, the music came into my mind. And in that moment, I found I could walk weakly, but fairly naturally and rhythmically. I walked for about 90 seconds or so, and then the music, the inner music, suddenly stopped, and I almost fell over, and I went back to the sort of funny robot leg. But here it was as if hearing the music was necessary to restore, you know, my own kinetic melody, my own memory of walking.
Do the neurologists who are studying music therapy, do they know what's going on? Have they made the connections with what's physiologically happening in the brain?
Well, some connections have been made. Parts of the auditory system, which are particularly sensitive to pitch, have been defined, and others which are sensitive to melody. One can have some particular diseases in which one becomes pitch deaf or melody deaf, but preserves the sense of rhythm. The sense of rhythm neurally seems to be at a deeper level in what are called the basal ganglia or subcortex, and this is these are the areas particularly knocked out in Parkinsonism. But it's clear that at least half a dozen different parts of the brain are involved in the perception and the apperception and the appreciation of music. But having said that, one also feels there's a deeper level in which music calls to the identity of the person. And the central question then becomes the neurology of identity, which is the deepest question of all, and which I think we've only started to approach very slightly at the moment.
Oliver Sacks says music therapy is a hot topic now for neurologists, even though they're just beginning to understand why it works. Sacks is the author of several bestsellers, including Awakenings and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. His most recent book is a memoir, Uncle Tungsten. Coming up, medical mistakes and mistranslations. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. So a patient who speaks only Spanish is sitting in the emergency room, and the very nice nurse, who speaks un poquito de español, tries to tell him that he's going to be admitted to the hospital. Only, instead of saying ingresado, which means admitted, she tells him he's going to be enterrado, which means buried. It's a true story, and just one of many that Shiva Bidarsilaf can tell. In her work as a medical interpreter, she's seen all sorts of mistakes, like the sign in the CAT scan waiting room that tells Spanish-speaking patients they're going to have an exploration of the cat, the animal, cat. More and more hospitals are hiring interpreters these days, as America's population grows ever more culturally diverse. Shiva Bidarsilaf told Ann Strainchamps that while linguistic mistakes can provide some comic relief, the real work medical interpreters do is a kind of cultural brokering.
Let me give you kind of an example of what can happen. The mother would call and say, okay, I need an urgent care appointment for my child. She has a high fever and is being very fussy for the last couple of days. Sounds like, you know, something that can happen very frequently to a baby, let's say. So you go to the appointment and the mother keeps mentioning, let's give an example of a Mexican mother, keeps mentioning the fact that this all started because of el susto, which is literally translated a fright. And it was because somebody left the house and just closed the door very quickly and made a loud noise, and it startled the baby. And if the provider is not aware of this cultural reference from the mother, they probably would just think it's just some description and it really is no big deal. At that time, the interpreter may say, doctor, if you don't mind, I would like to give you a little background of what she's meaning by el susto. And el susto, for example, is a cultural reference among Mexicans that refers to exactly that, the fact that if you see something happen that is frightening to you, you can immediately become sick. It is believed to be, for example, the cause of diabetes.
Are there specific diseases that you've found through your experience lead to the most kind of cultural gaps?
You see those things very often in pediatric patients, and I think the reason behind that is that there is, in most culture, a lot of different illnesses and different things that can affect children because children are very susceptible to everything. For example, one of the things that can happen is the evil eye. And what it usually is somebody just praising a child a lot, just saying, your child is just beautiful. I can't believe how, you know, beautiful he is. He just looks so great. And by this praising, that person could be really sending just some bad vibes, I guess is what you could call them, and make that person sick. Very often that person that is doing that doesn't even know that they're bringing the evil eye to that child. So it is difficult even for that person to know. But for example, if you're aware of that, that overpraising can be seen as something that could bring an illness to the child, you would be more careful about doing it. For example, among the Mexican patient, one of the things that often keeps the evil eye away is that as you're praising the child, if you touch the child, if you get close to the child, touch his or her head and say, oh, just, it's a beautiful child. And that usually is okay. Very often they wear amulets, either a bracelet or something around their neck that protects them against the evil eye. That's another thing. If a provider sees those amulets and sometimes they think, oh, you know, what is this? You know, this is unnecessary. Or you even hear sometimes comment about, take that off, that could be just dangerous for the child. You know, they could choke themselves with that, or, you know, it's not good to have anything hanging from your baby, just take that off. That kind of comment obviously can shows a lack of total cultural competency, because usually the parents are like, well, how can they tell me this? This is just such an important part of protecting my baby against any kind of illness.
What about vice versa? Have you ever been in a situation where the Western doctor says you have diabetes or you have allergy-induced asthma or is making some diagnosis, and the patient really doesn't have a cultural concept of that illness, or may, in their culture, may not believe that this is a real illness? Has that ever come up?
That comes up very frequently with chronic illnesses or illnesses that have a very bad prognosis. Diagnosing cancer among Hmong patients is very difficult, because as soon as the doctor tells a Hmong patient you have cancer, first of all, in those languages, there's usually not an exact equivalent, because obviously the Hmong medical system wasn't based on the same kind of things that the Western medical system is based off. So even things like cancer or diabetes may not have an exact equivalent in the other language.
So what does an interpreter do then?
An interpreter then usually tries to elicit some explanation from a doctor. It's like, could you use some other words to describe cancer? Very often what we've seen is those patients say, well, I don't see anything wrong with me physically. Because from the outside, as far as their body is concerned, everything that they can see with their eyes, everything looks okay. But somebody is telling them that there is something inside you that is going to kill you or could potentially kill you. So they have a complete mistrust of that kind of diagnosis.
So then I can see where this would get very ethically dicey for, or tense for, a translator, especially if the person's cancer really needs to be treated right away. How do you as a translator convey this?
Also, how do you explain to somebody that is just not even believing that your diagnosis is correct, that now you're going to be giving them chemotherapy and radiation, which is going to make them really, really sick? And sometimes those patients weren't really sick to start with. It just becomes an absolute two cultures just coming into collision, just because there's just no way people, you know, can understand why, you know, this doctor would be telling them this and then would be making them sicker, with the end goal that they're going to be actually cured from something that they didn't really think they had to start with.
So what are the thorniest cases like this that you've had yourself?
The thorniest case I think I've seen is a Hmong child that was diagnosed with leukemia. Oh. Again, it was very, very difficult because, of course, from the ethical perspective of the pediatrician, they wanted to do everything to save this child's life because they thought that with the existing treatment that there would be a good possibility maybe to cure this child. the family and the parents were refusing treatment for the child. So it becomes really a dilemma because it sometimes gets to the point, and in this case it involved the court system as far as the hospital trying to get custody of the child so that they could give the child treatment.
What happened?
The child did die at the end after all the treatment that they had received. The child died, and I think one of the things that happened is that that community where the child was coming from in small town in Wisconsin very much developed a total mistrust of the medical system.
I imagine when it gets into the area, not just of medical treatment, but of death and dying, it must get extremely difficult also because there are such different cultural attitudes toward, you know, the concept of what is a good death.
Death and dying is one of also the most difficult situations, especially because, again, the American medical system has developed these tenets. For example, one of the tenets is the right of the patient to know their prognosis and the fact that they're dying. Again, I think
are there cultures where people wouldn't want to know?
There is many cultures where people wouldn't want to know that they are dying.
Why not?
Many cultures that believe that just by knowing that you're going to be dying or just by being told that you're going to be dying, that's a certain death. So it's very difficult because even things like informed consent before you go to surgery, that's, again, one of the big tenets of American medical culture is you give the patient informed consent. And if you've ever read really an informed consent fully, and when it's explained to the patient, it says there is many risks to surgery, and one of the risks is dying. Well, when you're telling somebody that that's one of the risks, from a lot of different cultures, they think, well, then I'm not going to have this surgery, because just by the fact that they mention that there is a possibility of dying, it is going to happen.
Has this come up for you? Is there any particular people or family you remember that's come up with?
Yeah, we've had actually families where I remember one family where it was a young man who was here, and the parents were actually back in Mexico, and the family members that were here did not want the parents in Mexico to know the grave prognosis of this young man here. They thought that just by calling the family and letting them know that he was so sick, that first of all, he was certainly going to die, and that also that was going to make his parents really potentially sick, create illnesses in the family, just really bring a bad outcome for the entire family.
So what did you
do? It was very difficult because, again, from the Western perspective, it's like the next of kin were the parents, and it was so important to inform the parents about the gravity of the situation. At the end, we did convince the family that it was very important that the parents be aware of how difficult the situation was, and maybe even give them an opportunity of coming to the U.S. before their son died, which did happen. They were able to make it before their son died. So it becomes difficult to negotiate those things. And again, to impose your belief that you think the best thing from a Western medical perspective is to inform the family.
Are there any cases you think of when you think of cases that really worked out well, where there was some kind of strong cultural barrier and it really worked to get through it and doctor and patient wound up really understanding each other?
Yes, we had a case lately of a Hmong child that was diagnosed with cancer. And though it has not reached the point yet of conclusion, I think what really worked well in that instance is long conversations with the pediatric oncologist for this family. And having that pediatric oncologist go all the way to Appleton, the family had originally refused treatment and had gone back to Appleton and kind of pretty much said, we're just going to do our herbal remedies and use the shaman. We just really don't trust the diagnosis that you gave us. And so it took probably a whole day between traveling there, meeting with the family and coming back. But the next week, the family was down here in Madison. The child was admitted and was receiving treatment. Mm-hmm. So it really paid off to take that extra step and make that extra effort, lose that whole day to make that trip, but really gain so much in trust and confidence in the system from the family.
Shiva Bidar-Silov is a medical interpreter at the University of Wisconsin Hospital in Madison, Wisconsin. Anne Strangeham spoke with her.
So now you have a cold. You didn't do as you were told. You went out without galoshes in the rain. And you spent your late nights boozing instead of home a snoozing. And now you've just begun to feel the pain. The viruses inside of you are multiplying two by two and dance the Macarena in your brain. Your eyelids are thick and droopy. Your nose is raw and soupy. You ask for my advice, let me explain. You need to take acetaminophen or just a little aspirin, acetylsalicylic for the pain. A dose of guaifenesin, plain and simple Robitussin to liquefy the mucous membranes. Oxymetazoline or phenylpropanolamine to open up the sinuses and such. Then try to recoup with a little chicken soup, call your mother cause it pays to keep in touch. Then try to recoup with a little chicken soup, call your mother cause it pays to keep in touch. You have tried those new age therapies and herbal homeopathies, high colonic nozzles and the rest. But those echinacea potions and royal jelly lotions have failed to tame the panther in your chest. Those crystal packing druids cannot abate the fluids that drizzle from your nostrils to your vest. The answer, it is plain to see, is found within my pharmacy. So step right in and be my guest. You need to take acetaminophen or just a little aspirin, acetylsalicylic for the pain. A dose of guaifenesin, plain and simple Robitussin to liquefy the mucous membranes. Oxymetazoline or phenylpropanolamine to open up the sinuses and such. Then try to recoup with a little chicken soup, call your mother cause it pays to keep in touch. Say try to recoup with a little chicken soup, call your mother cause it pays to keep in touch.
Joel Mabus singing The Druggist from his CD Rhyme Schemes. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to buy a cassette copy of this hour, just call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for The Personal Medicine Show, number 47A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Special thanks for this hour to Renee Wagner. Our engineers this week were Marv Nunn and Kirill Wheeler.
PRI, Public Radio International.